Hello, everyone. This is the inaugural live podcast of Unfair and Unbalanced, a podcast with Roy Snell and Tom Fox. We are thrilled you are here today to watch us record. We've got live tweeting going, but with the size of the crowd, I'm sure we'll have a few hecklers throwing questions up. So if you throw it up, I will, I'll repeat it unless Courtney can get in front of you for the mic. So with that, welcome, Roy. Here we are at the 2016 Compliance and Ethics Institute. What have been some of your thoughts so far?
I've enjoyed it. We've had a good turnout. Matter of fact, it was big enough that we had a little trouble with space, but the staff did a great job sorting it out when we had some... I think this is one of our most interesting years for general session speakers because we typically try to have a lot of diversity of general session speakers, and sometimes we don't have enough of what I would consider stone cold veteran compliance types or ethics types. And this year, it was really, we leaned the other way. We had a lot of people who had a lot of great practical advice, and maybe the most interesting was Francesca, who has studied ethics via data as opposed to opinion. And she took a soft, vague science and made some sense out of it from a numerical standpoint or analysis, survey, data analysis, these sorts of things. And so I think we've had some fun. It's so far so good.
Well, today on day two, we had three keynotes that I found really interesting, very different yet very applicable to what we do. So the first one we had Bill Baer from the Department of Justice, and he gave the DOJ standard, we went after the banks, we prosecuted the banks, we will prosecute, and I'm just sitting there going, oh my God. And then he flipped to something completely different, which some people in this room, I think, perked up on as well, which was, here's what you have to do to get cooperation credit. And he went through the steps. And but when he started, he said, but wait a minute, before we even get to cooperation credit, you got to fulfill the obligations of the Yates memo. And that means you have to turn over facts on individuals. He said, that is it. That is now the how you get in to get cooperation credit. And then he listed the steps for cooperation credit. And within 5 minutes of his talk ending, the full text, full remarks of his speech were online at the DOJ site for speeches. So I'm going to pull that down, but if anybody's interested. And so really good information on the end there. The second keynote, Bill Johnson and Gwen Hassan talked about human trafficking and modern slavery. And Bill gave the same talk at the Utilities and Energy Conference in Houston. And I observed the same effect the second time I heard it. The room went dead silent. This was not typically, you know, I think when all of us think of modern slavery and trafficking, we think of the movie Taken, we think of the sex slave trade, and certainly that's a part of it. But there's a huge part. He gave a figure of 500,000 essentially modern-day slaves in America, people who were over here fitting the conditions of slavery working. He talked about five within miles of, he and Gwen talked about five within miles of O'Hare Airport. A very powerful talk, and how compliance fits into this. They're relatively new laws, and the government is forcing corporations to deal with the problem, and the answer is going to be compliance. But he did say that lots of companies are certifying that they are in compliance with the law, and they've committed a felony out of the box. And then he had another interesting point, which was this law is so new, it's not going to get a lot of play kind of within the Justice Department. I mean, you're going to get a junior lawyer, and that junior lawyer is going to be a very smart person, but they may probably have never worked in industry. And so when you come in, you've signed a certification that you're in complete compliance with federal law and you've not committed a felony, that's your starting point. And you have to have evidence of some type of compliance. So I found it interesting when they described the problem, the solution, and unfortunately, I don't think most companies have really thought through that solution part, so that's something we can need. And then Christy Grandmar, what a talk. I mean, just, I mean, I thought I was passionate about the bonds. And, you know, she is so passionate, and she wrote a book, How to Be a Wildly Effective Compliance Officer, and she took that passion and walked us through her steps to become a wildly effective compliance officer, and how you do with the negative Nellies, how you or deal with the negative Nellies in your corporation. So a great talk. She gave specific steps, communicating her passion and enthusiasm. Just a fabulous keynote to end the keynotes of day two. So a great start to day two, a great crowd. It's been an incredibly positive experience. I've forgotten what it's like to be with my people, you know, in one room. It's really cool.
I did talk about that on the first day, that I think people don't understand the concept of some of these conferences, whether it's ours or somebody else's. These people work in environments where people don't really understand what they do. Some, certainly in their department, understand, but other departments, and it can be a little frustrating on occasion. And you go from this environment of where you work, where maybe 10% of the people truly to the core get what a compliance program is and a compliance officer does, to here where there isn't a person in the room that doesn't understand what you do, and there's a really huge need for people in this profession to have people understand what they're doing, because we're back home some days fighting for things that just a lot of people are not for, and you just, am I right? Should I be doing this? And you come here and you can check. Sometimes you might find out your peers think you've gone too far, or they say, no, you're on the right course, you've got to get it done. One other comment about the human trafficking. This is a funny story I shouldn't admit, but I was all against doing any human trafficking presentations at utilities or any other conference. And Adam's been after it. Adam Turtletop, one of our staff, the VP of everything not nailed down, is what I call
it. You know, we didn't give you this kind of pen, so you wouldn't play. Put that back. Put that over there.
I'll hide the... with that part. So,
is he always like this?
Yes. Well, I actually brought a Red Bull so I'd be a little more interesting. I'm usually pretty laid back about all this. So Adam keeps coming at us and keeps coming at us at these meetings about we got to have human trafficking. I said, dude, this doesn't apply to a lot of people. I stepped out of the way, and Adam got these folks on the agenda at utilities and now here. And it's one of the beautiful things about our system. We, like you and I, have a lot of banter back and forth, agree and disagree and that sort of thing, but we try not to have a totalitarian system where people get to try out their ideas. Also, Christy, here's an odd comment about that. You know, we've been flailing away at this for 20 years. And we have some people who have been around since dirt, a little long in the tooth. And
that's soil, not dirt.
Yes, it's true. I taught Tom that you don't call dirt soil or soil dirt.
It really is like this all the time. This is not the show.
So here we are buzzing along, and a lot of the same people, and hearing from some of the folks who have been around for a long time again. And then out of nowhere comes somebody like Christy, who over the last 5 years have gone from relative anonymity to someone that the industry all knows and respects, and fills a really important role that really not a lot of us did. We've all been rah-rah, stick with it. This is a great profession, but she is off the chain. She is helping a lot of people.
Well, now let's turn to some current events. So every year I say things can't get any better anymore. So in 2012, we had Walmart. In 2013, we had GSK in China. In 2014, we started with Petrobras. In 2015, in the spring, we had FIFA. 2015, in the fall, we had Volkswagen. Here we are for the 2016 conference and what lays down in our lap last week, but Wells Fargo, and then 2 days later, Yahoo. So they'll probably be stuck studying. Well, first of all, I hope no one in the room from Wells Fargo. If you are, don't raise your hand, because we're going to talk about Wells Fargo. So, but what were some of your initial thoughts about Wells Fargo?
Well, I did the first cautionary tale thing, and as an organization, we have been very careful not to go too far down the road analyzing something that we don't have a lot of all the data. We have some very solid information on what happened. Wells Fargo, like VW, has shared some very clear facts about the number of people who have been released, the number of times the thing happened. And actually, part of it is already, in a way, settled. But I think the thing we always...
Small part.
Yeah, the more to come.
More to come.
I think that there's always some more that we don't know. But the thing I'd like to say, even with all that caution I just laid out on the table, is how does it go on this long? How does something happen reportedly over a million times? And by the way, these are problems. I hear all this time the defense attorneys, the regs are vague, the government's overreaching. There's too many regs. They're complicated. This is another story where a fifth grader could tell you that what was going on was wrong. And what I just think that the lesson that I'm going to wait till more information is in. But the lesson that I think we got to take from this, which is usually my peculiar view of things, is that. Does the compliance officer have independence, responsibility, and authority? Do they cover all risk areas? And are they allowed to use all the elements of a compliance program? If you have any kind of authority, if you have all risk areas, you could go anywhere and do anything, and use all elements of a compliance program, how do you not find out that this is happening and stop it somewhere around the 250,000th time? This is the piece that I would love to go there and empathetically say, I know I don't know everything, but could you explain to me how this wasn't caught and then attacked? And you know, a big part of compliance is coming in after you find the problem. Education, controls, follow-up audits, is it still happening? How is that any of that happening if they were discovering it all along, which is what I heard was happening? So
the thing that struck me, one of the things that struck me about Wells Fargo was I've heard you talk about the evolution and development of the compliance profession, specifically utilizing the financial fraud around Enron, WorldCom, other cases, where was compliance, why wasn't compliance in the room, didn't anybody have the ability or resources or authority within the corporation to stand up and say we should stop this. It seems that it's a further evolution of the risk, reputational risk now, that something as minor as these $2 million fake accounts or fraudulent accounts generated $400,000 for Wells Fargo.
Return on investment was very poor.
$240 billion corporation, $400,000 over 7 years. So extraordinarily minuscule money that they generated from these fraudulent accounts. And the second thing is that something as what I think is absolutely benign as a financial services product could become such a high risk if taken to an unreasonable extreme. So what is risk? Well, everything is involved in risk. If you're selling a bank card, that could be risk.
Yep.
And that there needs to be some visibility into this.
Yeah.
So does that really play into kind of how you've seen the profession evolve?
Well, yeah, it's fascinating. It's happened for 20 years. I mean, when the first stupid thing I ever said in compliance is I told somebody, a woman named Kathy Berner came to me, and I was a compliance officer in a healthcare system, and I said, it's all about billing. We're going to focus on billing. That's the biggest risk area. That's what we're going to focus on. And she said, you should focus on all risk areas. And I told her she was wrong, that you have to go after where the big problems are. And then about 2 years later, hopefully sooner than that, I smacked myself in the forehead and said, she's absolutely right. Since then, I've watched industry after industry say, well, our biggest risk is this, so we're going to wrap our whole compliance program around this thing. And I've seen a few industries do this, and one of them, I don't know them well enough to be sure of this, but financial services investment advisors are so crazy focused on insider trading and regulated by law to focus on insider trading, then I don't think they're looking down the hall at one of the biggest risk areas in the building. That's a risk area for every organization that has financials, which is like every organization, about accounting fraud. And so, yeah, one of the things that we need to do as a profession is to say that the compliance professional should have all the tools available to them, every element of a compliance program, and they should do all risk areas. I'm going to give you one more example. Back home in Minneapolis is a company named Target, which is one of the best companies in the country, in my opinion. They had a credit card problem, and they announced shortly thereafter a press release that they had hired, or were going to hire, a new chief information officer and a new compliance officer. And I thought, this is symbolic to me. Not a lot of other people would read into it, but why would you announce after a major IT failure the announcement of a new position in compliance too, or a new hire? And I think the bell goes off. I think this is how it happens. The leadership sits there and looks and says, and I know everybody thinks every CEO knows everything that's going on in their company and they're all guilty of covering it up. I don't believe that. I think the CEO sits in the room and says, we did what? We did it how many times? And they at some point turn and say to the compliance officer, where were you? You were supposed to prevent, find, fix ethical and regulatory problems. That's what you told me. And the compliance officer slides over their job description and says, you have it burned in a limited number of risk areas. IT wasn't in my risk area. So I couldn't go in. I didn't have the authority. Well, it's in there now. That phrase should be burned into a plaque at our office at SEC.
It's in there now?
It's in there now. Eventually, people can try and restrict the role of the compliance officer all they want, but every time there is a major failure in a risk area that they don't cover, leadership will say, isn't your system supposed to be to prevent, find, and fix things of this type? And yeah, but you didn't have it in my job description. And I've been trying to tell you, we should be able to go anywhere and do anything. It's in there now because I'm mad because we're in the press and it was for a lame reason. Like, if we understand Wells Fargo well enough to say this, that they didn't benefit much even from the fact that they were doing this silly thing. The compliance officer should have been able to go in there and rattle some cages.
So how does something like a benign product, like a financial service or a debit card, coupled with incentives, become something so toxic?
Oh, don't get me started here. I'm going to get into all kinds of trouble. I actually got some feedback personally from someone who handled it pretty nicely about something I tweeted related to this, is that I'm pretty tired of people blaming others for their failures. And the easy one is everybody blames the leadership, but we all have to have incentives. I mean, I'm sorry. If it's not written, if it's not financial, you have to say to somebody, I'm going to pay you a salary, I'm going to pay you benefits, and in return, I want you to do some stuff. And if you don't do that stuff, I'm going to fire you. So we put it into numbers, and a few of the people decide, I'm going to cheat to get this accomplished. And then they pull out their violin and they say, oh, my family, I have to feed my family. I had no choice. And all the bleeding hearts, frankly, some of them in our profession, oh, those poor people, they had to feed their family. They had no choice. Yeah, you have a choice. You can quit. I'm sick and tired of giving excuses to anybody
who said, yeah, I cheated, and I cheated because of them. And I'm pointing for those who, I guess we are. Normally we're not on video. I'm pointing at Jay. I'm cheating because of Jay. And I say, no, where's the personal accountability? I don't care if somebody pushed him too hard. You also are supposed to say, I don't care how hard I'm pushed, how hard I'm bullied, how many of my colleagues are doing this. That's wrong. I'm not going to do it. And if you give people an out, this is where the Red Bull just kicked in. If you give people an out, we're going to just have people, look, I can do this, because every time I do it, I'm just going to say, well, the man pushed me. And so the people in the public sentiment would be that I was innocent. No, there was 1,000 people who were under this financial incentive system. And X number of them chose to cheat to get the win and the money. And the X number, the rest of them said, over my dead body, this is not me. I'm either going to stay here at whatever success rate I have at selling or whatever it is, or I'm going to get fired, or I'll choose to leave if I think this is really a bad environment. We have to tell every individual that they are personally accountable for ethical behavior. If we continue to give this massive out in all the press, oh, the poor people were pressured into doing this because they have to feed their family and keep their job. I'm sorry. That is utter nonsense. And I'd use a different word if it weren't being recorded. I'm sorry. I'm really... Please, you want to... Anybody got anything? We'll jump around.
Any questions at this point?
Jim, sure.
So this is the first studio audience question ever for the Unfair podcast.
It better be a fair and balanced question.
I'm honored to be the first question here. I somewhat see Roy's point that we shouldn't let people off the hook by saying that they had no choice, except for the fact that a considerable majority of people on this planet, really, they don't have a choice. It's just most of them don't live here. Most of them don't attend our conference. Most of them don't attend white-collar jobs or anything like that. And a lot of them, yeah, you know, sure, you can exercise your ethical responsibilities, and then you're still left with no job and no way to feed your kids. Sounds good in principle until the kid actually starts crying because he's hungry. I think we also need to remember, for a lot of people, that is a very real reality. Not necessarily in this country, in the United States, but in the developing world,
right,
that is part of it. And the other thing, and then I'll be quiet, is that I think if you are going to exercise your ethical responsibility, which, again, you should, it only makes sense to do that if that is rewarded. And if it gets punished, then there are too many companies where if you speak up and say this is wrong, they do say you're fired. And getting fired sucks. We need to break away from that. If they allow a speak up culture and says, this stinks, I'm not going to do it, I'm all for it.
Yeah,
but we're not there yet.
So this is why I love doing these podcasts with Tom, because if I say something wrong or unclear, Tom helps clarify it. That's why these have been a lot of fun, and I think you've helped clarify it. I'm speaking only about the United States.
Okay.
I know enough about other countries to completely agree with you, but I don't know enough to really opine about it. I'm just saying in this country, there are enough jobs. People have got to stand up for what's right and stop blaming other people for their behavior. I think it's true for the C-suite as much as it's true for the people in the trenches who are telling everybody, in my opinion, incorrectly, that I got an incentive, so it's an implication that I should lie, cheat, and steal. And I think they should refuse to do it.
Hi, so this is the second question.
There you go.
I'm either. So for looking at the U.S., for me, I think it really annoyed me when I read about Yahoo, and I looked at Marissa Mayer, and I thought, are you serious? Because to me, it was just so elemental. How stupid could you be? And I don't actually believe she didn't know what was going on, because she knew a lot. But I mean, it'll come out in the wash as we go through. And then I look at Wells Fargo, another major institution, and I'm I felt like walking over to a wall and actually hitting my head on it, because I'm thinking, this is so elemental. And why did we let it get so far when we have so much more focus on things these days? There's so much more larger fines. They know that the DOJ are looking at it. So I do have this lack of understanding sometimes of people's behavior, although I do understand it happens.
Tom, keep going.
So with Wells Fargo, the banking industry is, if not the most, certainly one of the most regulated industries in this country. And they have a ton of risk officers. And with 250,000 employees, I'm sure a large contingent in their risk department. And yet this was allowed to not only fester, but grow and be celebrated within the company. So the first question is, where is risk? And being from Texas, it's great to be around people from Cambridge. They're always more liberal than me, so thank you. Just fabulous. But that's the role of risk, and that's the role of compliance. And sometimes risk has to say no, and they have to stand up for the person who can't stand up for themselves or won't stand up for themselves because of economic circumstances. So where was the risk department? Where was the compliance department? If they, and it's going to lead into some other discussions we're going to have, is should risk and compliance be a part of compensation discussions? Should they be a part of pricing discussions? Is pricing now such a high risk? And we can talk about EpiPen and other pricing models. Is pricing such a high risk that there needs to be compliance oversight?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's certainly one thing when you're selling a $10 product or a 50-cent product for $600 in the healthcare space. But now we have, and I keep going back to this, as just as benign a product as a debit card, and that pricing and that compensation structure and that compensation incentives given to employees led to this huge problem for Wells Fargo. So kind of where was risk?
And I would, we would maybe take one more related to Wells Fargo, and then I think we need to move on to a couple of other topics I want to bug Tom about.
Right, I do have a comment, and maybe drawing the comments from our first question and also Roy's point about the individual responsibility of someone being able to say no. So maybe as a comment from someone who works in Asia, works in China, works in Hong Kong, that maybe the individual responsibility needs to be transcended to, I don't want to say CSR because that word's tired, that term is a bit 2000, but as a company, as a US company, the board and the CEO has a choice to manufacture in China and take advantage of a cheaper, low-cost resource base. Or I have a choice to manufacture in a place which has, where the people are incentivized less to commit misconduct, to tarnish my name. And so maybe the responsibility is to go back to the board to say, as a company, do you want to take advantage of somewhere where it's easy for you to get yourselves in trouble? And I think they don't really think about the consequences of this risk. I think they look at profit, they look at the margins, and every year they say, I need to turn over great margins for my investors so I can move on to the next big CEO position.
I'm just going to make one last comment, then I want to ask Tom about a couple other things here, but I think your point about corporate social responsibility is right. I think we are slipping, we have to be very careful to in our profession to slip into corporate social responsibility. I don't believe it's the compliance officer's job. If there are laws associated with it, like human trafficking, I'm all for it. But we can't be all things to all people. There are other people working on that. We have to find where people are breaking the rule of law and stop it. And if we start getting into other issues, we're going to become incredibly diluted and lack focus. Let me give you one example. Tom, should compliance officers get involved in setting the salary of the CEO?
So there's been a lot of negative publicity about salaries of CEOs, how much they've grown. I don't think chief compliance officers should be involved in setting of the base salary. I do have different views on compensation structure, because that's where, specifically with Mylan and the EpiPen matter, I think the comp beyond base salary got the company in trouble.
because I think the CEO was incentivized to hit certain numbers of stock price, and you can only do that by jacking up the price of previously existing products that were relatively low. And so I think when it comes to compensation other than base salary, I think compliance needs to have at least visibility into that, and companies need to understand that if it all goes down the tubes, this is going to be a huge, huge reputational hickey that you're going to get.
So what I hear you saying is no to base, yes to incentives.
Yes.
Yeah, that's good. I agree completely. There are folks in our profession who believe that we ought to get involved in CEO salary setting, and that is a social issue, and it is absolutely beyond the scope of the compliance officer. If you start trying to get involved as a compliance officer in the CEO salary and pricing, here's another way to describe it. Where the heck does it stop? We should be running the company.
Did you hear me last night? We are running the company.
Yeah. You were pretty passionate last night. By the way, we like to jump around a lot. It's one of the beautiful things of these podcasts. We just left turn so great. We should be wearing neck braces. Tom last night we give awards away 4 or 5 a year for the last 10 years or so. And Tom got an award last night specifically for his contributions to the rest of the world. He just gives. He writes and blogs and teaches and gives greatly. I hope we give back enough to at least be fair about this. We'll never give you back as much as you've given us. And as a result, we gave him an award. And for those who are watching, it is a beautiful thing, an Oscar. As a matter of fact, this is kind of a funny ethical issue. These people make this award, and it looks just like an Oscar. And apparently they got sued. And on here somewhere, maybe on the base, maybe it's not there now, but they had to write, or maybe it's in the marketing materials, "This is not an Oscar." Was the settlement they had. We're giving away a little unethical thing here, but Tom gave, here's the point I want to make. When we first did this award thing, we didn't see something coming. The people who got the award got up, and the vast majority of them said things about this profession and the people in the audience about how great the profession is and how great things are, and we're empathetic to the profession and complimentary of the profession, as you were last night. And of all the people who accepted, they were all wonderful, but yours really followed the spirit of something that has happened organically. And I want to thank you for, instead of getting up there and say, "You know, you're right, I'm wonderful," you got up and said, "You know, I want to take this moment to say how wonderful the profession is." So, well done.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm going to...
Your turn.
Can I do another big left turn? Arnold Palmer passed away a couple days ago.
He did.
And I just wrote an article once, and I happen to believe that the ethical culture of the golfing community, the professional golfing particularly, is just stunning. And how it got started and how it happened, I think we talked about this once. And Arnold Palmer was just the epitome of the kind of human being that we should all seek to be. His integrity and empathy for others and humbleness was just phenomenal. And, you know, he trended on Twitter for a couple of days or whatever, but, you know.
You're really into the social media thing.
Yeah, I know.
Really.
Well, since we trended, have we talked about this yet?
Not yet.
Podcast?
See, it really does go on.
For those of you listening, we trended on Twitter this week. This compliance community, in my opinion, SCCE, CEI hashtag for this conference, was actually trending. I think I did again today, 2 days. Yeah, pretty cool. Here's my point.
He always gets around.
I have a point.
He does.
Is that we'll talk about Lochte for 2 weeks. We'll talk about Arnold Palmer for 2 days. I tweeted this out the other day. We celebrate people who had a moment of no integrity or aren't I don't know Lochte well enough to say he doesn't have integrity. I just know he had a moment, but you lost it if you have it. We'll talk about him for a week. That was like a one mistake at night, and it's stupid, and it's wrong, and it's up. But 2 weeks, everybody all day talking about him. Arnold Palmer, one of the highest integrity people that we see in the public, and it's like nothing. It's just infuriating. I wish there was a way we could fix that. How do we fix that?
Well, we celebrate those people, and we talk about those people. And we try to hold those people up as teaching tools, teaching moments, people that we can aspire to be. And I guess that means I need to blog about Arnold Palmer.
I would like to see you do that. And as the fact that I haven't decided to do that until just now, it's a good thing. Did you have something you just were going to say?
No, it's your turn to ask questions.
Okay. How about, does anybody have a topic? Just a topic that...
Leona, did you have a question?
I guess my comment is more along the lines of analogy. When we're talking about risk versus, you know, corporate social responsibility, the responsibility of the individual and the responsibility of leadership, when in the Wells Fargo case, unfortunately I'm going back to that, you know, definitely people should be held responsible for their bad behavior. And I can't say that I have a lot of sympathy for that situation. However, there's a certain number of times, it's like when you design a product to do something, and over again you get reports of people using it wrong and hurting themselves. You could always explain away, well, they're using it wrong. There is a point where you have to admit there's bad design. And this is a situation where there was bad design that could encourage this behavior. And actually, just knowing how much information flows through some of these companies, it's actually very easy to overlook the cumulative effect of that behavior that you don't see.
Yeah. It's like a virus or a fungus, and it just grows and grows.
Right.
And conversely, like in the case of the golfing community, it is a virus in the other direction. It good behavior, proper behavior, honesty, integrity, grows like a weed. That's an interesting point. That there's it's like a teeter totter. If you can get the momentum headed in the right direction and keep pushing, you can go to good places. Or if you don't focus on it and let bad behavior go on, and somebody in another department will say, well, they're doing that over there, I guess I'm going to do it. So it's a good point.
And also, but that doesn't excuse not trying to find out.
We've had a patient person in the back.
Yeah.
She has the best comment of all so far, I'm pretty sure.
No pressure.
I'm sure I have the best comment. Because I'm Roy's favorite, remember?
That's a fact. She's got the tape to prove it.
I was thinking when we were talking about Wells Fargo and Yahoo, and I hate to keep talking about that, but it made me think about something when we were talking about, well, this is what happens overseas. Well, let's stay right here in the U.S. And so we talked about what we need to celebrate when people make good decisions, right? And so when you have a C-level or executive person at a company who does decide to stand up for what's right, not engage in illegal or unethical behavior, whether they are a compliance officer or someone else, perhaps they become a whistleblower, and then the worst thing for them does happen. They do get terminated, right? So if we celebrate them, what does that mean? Because now they have lost their ability to provide for their family. They have to hire an attorney. They have to file a lawsuit for wrongful termination. They have to go through a trial court, which, you know, will have continuance. And then when there's a decision there, if the company that they whistleblowed on is unhappy with the decision, now they have to go through appeals court and perhaps Supreme Court. So 4 or 5 years after they've done the right thing, and all of us have forgotten about what they did, now they get some sort of justice. But in the meantime, They haven't just lost that executive role. And if we're talking about someone at a large company, that they do have a duty to all of us to do the right thing. They've lost, you know, several hundreds of thousands of dollars a year income and a reputation, right? Someone might say, oh, they did the right thing. But if they're terminated and they go and apply for another job, that's on their record now. So they're thinking about that as well. And how do they explain that, right? They could go in there and say, but I did the right thing. Yes, I was terminated, but, you know, I did the right thing. And the other person on the other side of the table is like, yeah, you're a great person. I'm glad you did the right thing, but I don't know if I want you to come work here because maybe you're actually a troublemaker. I don't know. You were the president of that company or the vice president of that company. I don't know you personally. I don't know that you don't have some other alternative. And I bring that up because that's very much a scenario that's going on right now. And so celebrating them means what? How do we bring this to be something? Because what could happen is reverse psychology in the other departments. They see a president or vice president, right thing, terminated, doesn't get satisfaction for 5 years, loses their home or whatever. And so the other department C-suite persons are doing what? I'm not gonna stand up. I should, but look at what happened to Joey. Well, look at what happened to Susan. And so it's not just about that one person doing the one right thing and celebrating that one right person, but then how do we, if something negative happens because they did the right thing, how do we continue to encourage the other persons left still at that company or at other companies to continue to do the right thing?
I'm gonna give this one to Tom.
So,
I know that's long, sorry.
So as everyone knows, I'm a recovering lawyer. But the answer here is, I think the legal response will drive the cultural response. And the legal response is that now, for the first time, we had a whistleblower case where front pay was awarded. Front pay means the money you would have earned had you not been terminated, not what you lost because you were terminated. So it can be a huge number because it's multiplied out with compounded or single interest. So that it can really increase the size of the reward. And if you make it so financially painful for a company, that will start the change, the drive in culture. So hopefully by courts accepting front pay for whistleblowers, that will start to drive a conversation in companies because they will say, it's too expensive for us to engage in this kind of behavior. We're not going to engage in this kind of behavior. So I think the legal response will hopefully drive the cultural response, but you're absolutely right. That's a huge problem, and we're just going to have to change it through communication and legal response and trying to talk about it.
I'm gonna ask Tom another question here, and if somebody else has a topic or a question, topics or questions, that would be great. SAI Global.
Yes.
Just got sold for how much?
$1 billion.
What do you think of this?
So, the people in this room, know SAI Global as part of the compliance community, a service provider, a product provider in the compliance community. They are, as I understand, one of 17 either subsidiaries or companies within a greater SAI Global.
Yeah.
So what I don't know is how much of the compliance work is the entire company. But the entire company was sold for $1 billion, so I, at this point I can't evaluate whether that's a new harbinger of greatness for compliance providers.
They happen to have a booth here. I happened to talk to one of the guys in the booth, and I said, I just don't understand $1 billion for a compliance company, and we had talked earlier yesterday, and I said, there must be something else I'm missing here. And he says, yeah, and he rattled off some other things that they're doing that are just gigantically bigger and different and non-compliant. So my first reaction was, holy cow, a compliance company got sold for $1 billion. And pretty quickly we all realized there must be something else there.
Well, and the other thing is I read some articles anticipating you would harangue me with this question. I read some articles in the Australian press. It's an Australian company. It was actually viewed in Australia as a distressed company that was bought at a very low price. So the billion was viewed as a very good deal.
A good deal. And I think that there's some indication that there might be some other things
yes.
going on that maybe are not as publicly available right now that adds value to the organization. Do we have any other topics or questions?
Lewis?
An undercurrent that I think we're starting to hear more and more at this conference is really just the word culture. It gets thrown in constantly into almost every discussion in compliance nowadays. And I think that even harkening back to your discussion about risk and really looking at all of the risks of an organization, you don't get to do that unless you actually have a culture that's willing to bubble those up,
right?
And you're able to find them. So the concept of compliance officer as culture driver, I would say that most organizations would, in the first, shudder at that a little bit, because culture has always been the purview of HR and others. And yet, I think that the concept of compliance culture and the concept of doing the right thing is actually probably the highest calling of the compliance officer. And how do we really make that shift as a profession, and as we become more of a profession, to really always having that focus that we're driving more than just compliance with a given regulation or law, but we are in fact creating a culture where people care deeply about getting things right.
I was just talking to Ryan Mead this morning, who has put together one of the best compliance degrees in the country at Loyola, and he said something I never heard and never thought about, and he was just profoundly correct, that he thinks that there are, let me put it this way, I've always been concerned that there's some people who have the title compliance and ethics officer, and all they do is run around all day saying, let's do the right thing. They don't want to audit, they don't want to monitor, they don't want to investigate, they don't like the stick, they want to carry it. If we just tell everybody to do the right thing, we're all going to be magically okay. Go beyond compliance to ethics. If you ever want to see my head explode, give me a Red Bull or say go beyond compliance
to
ethics. Yeah, it's pretty funny. He loves doing this. So Ryan Mead says to me, kind of what you're saying in a different way, just the opposite. I think some people have slapped the word ethics on their compliance title, and they're really not all in. And Ryan and I actually kicked around some ideas. SECE has always been, admittedly, and no hiding the mission, big C, little E. We're very focused. We have an ethics track here. We have an ethics publication that Courtney manages. It's not like we're not doing anything, but we feel that the biggest weakness out there is enough people talking about ethics that we need somebody to be really strong in the compliance area. Maybe it's time to go back and make the E a little bigger and start talking to people about the opposite problem. There are two possible problems and one ideal. Where the ideal is, I'm not sure. A compliance and ethics officer who thinks ethics is the solution and forget all the other risk areas. And there's a compliance officer who focuses on all the elements but doesn't work on building an ethical culture. So I agree that we need to make sure that people are doing it, but they always got to make sure we keep that balance. You look excited to be alive.
I'm always excited to be alive, Roy. I mean, your presence. So I want to tie what you just said in, no pun intended, about the culture part and the part we were talking about, the compliance officer being involved in the compensation of a CEO. Why not take it a step further? If you're going to involve the compliance officer or the head of compliance, the compensation committee, why not start at the ground floor and have them involved in the nomination and governance committee choosing the CEO? Because if you're looking in a culture, a corporate culture, then surely the compliance officer choosing a CEO who has an inherent good culture becoming the CEO, he's going to spread the tone from the top. So surely a compliance officer being involved in the Gov committee, surely that's
going to
be a good start.
First of all, I want to thank Ty, because this is exactly the kind of thing that we love to talk about, is not the dang thing that's been rehashed a million times. Personally, this is the first time I recall, maybe you're just being more clear than others have and I missed it, but being a compliance officer, being involved in the selection committee. Where you were first going was making me a little bit nervous. I thought maybe it was more of this, you know, let's be in charge of the whole country, let's save the whales and be involved in all social responsibilities thing, or decide the C-suite salary. And by the way, I agree with Tom on the base, no to the base, yes to incentives, we should be involved. But as a advisor, not the decider. I have never thought about this being involved, and I'll take it further, selection of board members, selection of also maybe some bunch of C-suite folks, certainly the CEO. I'm all in.
Well, this is talking about culture. So if you want to change the culture of a company, then surely changing the culture of the C-suite executives and the board is the perfect place to start. So that's surely where the compliance officer should.
So Ty is saying, we maybe picked that up on the mic, Ty is saying that, you know, one of the many ways, you know, and having an ethical culture is 1,000 little acts a year. It's not like doing a video with the CEO. You've got to look everywhere you can possibly ding the bad culture and 1,000 little things. And I think, I can't wait to hear Tom, being an advisor, not in charge of the company, but being an advisor in the selection committee or nomination, really. I mean, I don't know how you nominate CEOs, but certainly not made board members, I suppose, but what do you think, Tom?
So on both Ty's question and Lewis's point, what I would phrase it in the following, that compliance needs to be burned into the DNA of your company. And Roy's right, you do that through a million different little acts. Whether that be communicating culture, utilizing your HR department to communicate that message of culture, every time HR has a touch point with an employee in the pre-employment screening and the onboarding and any annual evaluation and any salary evaluation and any promotion or even a termination, every one of those employee touch points, HR can communicate something about the values of your company. And to your point, Ty, that I would argue that that's exactly the role of compliance, and that's exactly what compliance should be doing. You should always evaluate from a cultural standpoint, any CEO, senior manager, or even person you're promoting up into management, and compliance needs to be a part of that. There needs to be extensive due diligence on anyone that's brought into that level, and someone needs to, whether it be the chief compliance officer, the audit committee, or compliance committee of the board, have a very serious conversation about what the CEO sees as cultural values and how the CEO wants to implement that through his compliance function. So absolutely.
I want to share one quick story about a company I won't name, but we had their ethics officer come speak at our, may have been the first one, coincidentally, the first one of these we ever did. And she was going on and on and on about ethics. And somebody in the audience says, excuse me, what do you do about compliance? We leave that to the departments. About a year or two later, their CEO was fired for what was considered an ethics violation. I'm not going to name it. I wish I could because it would make the story better, but I just don't want to implicate this organization. And to your point, Ty, maybe this individual should have been involved in the selection of that CEO. But then they hired another CEO, and maybe that ethics officer or the compliance officer, as Tom's point is, an ethics officer say, well, do you believe in doing good? And the compliance officer say, let's do a background check here, you know? So that was probably too big a sweeping generalization. I'd like to take that back. Push rewind.
No, you're on the record.
I'm screwed. And, so
the, no, you're not editing that.
So the story goes on, though. This organization has an ethics officer, really no compliance officer, who poo-poos compliance, lost the CEO to an ethics violation, and then they hire a new one. And to Ty's point, maybe they should have been involved in the rehiring, for sure by now. You'd think, but maybe not. Surely didn't look like it when he was soon fired for an ethics violation. And more, far more egregious, I would say. The first one was somewhat debatable. The second one was just stone cold black and white. You would throw anybody out for what he did. So this is a neat concept. I can't believe I never recommended or talked about it. Thank you for bringing up something odd and different, like Tom and I.
Leon?
I
I think what I would like to see, and maybe I'm just calling out to the audience of people who might be listening to this podcast, is more discussion on how the behaviors of a good compliance culture are also happen to be the behaviors that keep businesses afloat. Because, you know, having been in an industry that is struggling with disruption by the retail industry by competitors, often, you know, you have companies dragging their feet because they don't want to look at problems. They don't want to be honest with themselves. I mean, sometimes those kinds of values are important to also important to cultural compliance or a culture of compliance. And actually, moving the culture of compliance can really change people's behavior about a lot of other things. You know, I was having a discussion with somebody today here at SCCE, and she was having trouble with the leadership and the gifts and gratuities policy. And I'm like, well, if it's that bad, you know they're also stealing from you. I mean,
someone from the retail industry.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you have a culture where people are allowed to feel entitled, where people are allowed to cover stuff up that they're getting, where people are taking it seriously that there's an ethical consequence, they're doing that other places too.
I would say the very basis of financial controls are segregation of duties and oversight. And that's the basis of compliance. The compliance controls are segregation of duties and appropriate oversight. That is why a company that is run better typically is more compliant, because they have financial controls that split the decision-making authority and then have oversight over people to have the ability to spend money for the corporation. So I think there's a business response to that. I think the business response is to have more robust financial controls and call them compliance controls, because they really are compliance controls. And that's how you can begin to start to change that culture. Roy, we've got 1 minute left.
If we're that short, I would like to make one comment. I've been doing these with Tom, and I've never been able to do it with a crowd and say anything like this in front of folks. I assume people listen later, but Tom's just a blast to do this with. First of all, I think we come at it from completely different backgrounds. He has a whole lot more experience in education in certain areas than I do, and it's been fun to cover these because I think we take fundamentally different approaches, but we agree on enough that we're not always at each other's throats. And the thing that you do that is just a blast, man. You tell me I'm wrong all the time, and you don't make me feel like I'm an idiot too. I wish more people could have these sorts of more open conversations, particularly in this day and age in this country where we seem to not be able to talk about things. First of all, you're told from the thought police, you can't talk about that, you can't think about that, that's not the answer I'm looking for, so you're politically incorrect and shut up. And I'm very concerned about where the discourse is going in this country. Not only from you not being permitted to discuss certain ideas, but also and then we'll burn your house down if you disagree. So I got to tell you, this has been an absolute blast because you don't do that stuff.
It's fun for me. So, and thank you to the audience for coming down and watching us record a podcast.
Thank you.